Okay, so we see in chapter 4, in a sense, what we saw in chapter 3. The approach to God is always through a blood sacrifice. That's the only way to approach God and meet with Him, yes? Oh, that's obviously obvious, because before the fall there was no forgiveness necessary. Okay, I'll temper it. After the fall, the approach to God was always and has always been through a blood sacrifice. Okay? Now, in chapter 5, we have the genealogy going from Adam down to Shem, Ham, and Japheth, who are the sons of Noah, the three sons of Noah. And they had wives, each one of them. Noah had a wife. And so when we get to chapter 6, and 7, we have the story of the flood. And Noah builds an ark. And those 8 people, Noah, his wife, his 3 sons, and the wives of his 3 sons, are the only human beings left alive after the flood, because they're on the ark and being protected by God. Now, the reason for the flood, there's 2 reasons. One was because the wickedness of man had become so repugnant that God said, I got to just cleanse this. I got to wipe this out and start over again. The second reason for the flood was, if you remember, the Nephilim. We talked about how angels had sexual relationships with human women, and the offspring were these Nephilim. And what Satan was trying to do was corrupt the line of the seed, corrupt mankind, because the Messiah had to be fully human in order to die for the sins of humanity. And so Satan was trying to corrupt humanity, and especially the line of the seed. The flood destroyed all the Nephilim. And so that's the purpose for the flood. So then, in chapter 8, Noah disembarked from the ark. And one thing that's important, in Genesis 8, and let's look at verse 18, it says this. So Noah went out, and his sons and his wives, and his sons' wives with him. So they left the ark. Every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves on the earth, went out by their families from the earth. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and took of every clean animal, and of every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. So the first thing Noah does when he disembarks is builds an altar and offers God a blood sacrifice, reaffirming the fact that just as a blood sacrifice was needed in order to have a relationship with God prior to the flood, it's also necessary to have a blood sacrifice subsequent to the flood in order to appease God and be a have a propitiation. That means a satisfaction for sin. The blood sacrifice satisfies God's sense of justice. So Noah did that. And then the other thing in chapter 8, which carries over to chapter 9, is the covenant that God enters into with Noah. It's called the Noahic covenant. And it says in verse 21, the Lord smelled the soothing aroma, that was the sacrifice that Noah offered up, and the Lord said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, and this is interesting what he says here, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. Now, if you think about it, why did God pick those things that they indicate that God would never bring a flood again? Well, during the time of the flood, when all the mountains were covered, there was no seed time, there was no harvest, there was neither cold nor heat, there weren't any seasons, and there wasn't even any day or night. All that stopped for that period of time during the flood, because the sun was completely blocked from view, and because of the conditions that were existing during the flood, the normal cycle of nature was disrupted. God said that will never happen again, which means there can never be a flood again. And now God, now God enters into a covenant with Noah. Now, this is the third covenant now in the Bible that we're seeing. The first one was what we call the Edenic covenant, and that's the covenant that God entered into with Adam prior to the fall, that he should keep the garden, that he should multiply on the earth and subdue it and so forth. The second covenant was what we call the Adamic covenant, and that's the covenant that God made with Adam, and you know, through Adam to with all humanity after the fall. He entered into a covenant with Adam, or you might say Adam and Eve. And then this is the third covenant. Also, by the way, bear in mind, when we go to each one of these covenants, if you take a covenant and list all of the provisions of that covenant, when you come to the next covenant, you don't automatically assume that all of the provisions of the preceding covenant are just done away with. Sometimes there are aspects of a covenant that are done away with. Sometimes there are aspects of a particular covenant that carry over into the next covenant and possibly continue to carry over. Okay? So we don't want to, you know, just slice and dice the covenants when we go through this. When I say now God's entering into a covenant with Noah, that doesn't mean that all of the aspects of the previous covenants are void. Okay? And we'll see that illustrated here. So God blessed Noah and his sons, and remember, blessing is a major theme in the Bible, and especially in Genesis. Blessing and creation are two major themes. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So that's something that's being carried over from the Edenic covenant, right? But remember he said that to Adam? Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And now here's something that's new. The fear of you and the terror of you will be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are given. So dominion is still, that's carried over, right? Into your hand they are given. Adam still has, humanity still has dominion over animals, but the relationship between humans and animals is different from the way it was prior to the flood. Now, animals are scared of human beings, and they are. Animals are nervous around human beings. They don't like, and if you ever want to test that, it's very easy. Just go out where there's some birds pecking on the ground looking for food and try and walk up to one. You can't. They'll walk away, and if you get too close, they'll fly away. So, yeah, there are some animals that we can domesticate, but it's nothing like it was before the flood. Because before the flood, Noah was able to bring all these animals onto the ark. Couldn't do that today. Just have all the animals come onto the ark. Now, here's another thing that's new. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant. So now another thing that's a change is before the flood, all creatures were vegetarians. Now, man is no longer going to be a vegetarian. He's going to be a meat eater. If people, you know, every generation has its fanatics, and we have no lack of fanatics in our generation. And there are people who say you should not eat meat because, and they have all these becauses. It's cruel, it's this, it's that. God is sovereign, and God has told man that now you will eat meat. Now, if somebody chooses not to eat meat, they can do that under the law of Messiah, the law of grace. If somebody chooses to eat meat, they may do that too. So we're not to judge one another for these things. But as a race, the human race is now carnivorous. Right. And what we see is that that's not scriptural. Then it goes on to say, only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is the blood. So even back in the days of Noah, when they would eat flesh, meat, they were to remove all the blood from the animal first. And there's ways to do that. Remove all the blood first. Don't eat blood, because blood is what is shed so that sins can be forgiven. So that's kind of sanctified and set apart. Then it says, surely I will require your lifeblood. From every beast I will require it. And from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of a man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And so now there's something new that didn't exist prior to the flood. That is capital punishment administered by humans, specifically by human government. And prior to the flood, there was no capital punishment. Notice Cain was not put to death for killing his brother. He was severely punished, but he was not put to death. But now there's capital punishment. And so the fact of the matter is, the debate over capital punishment, It's not like eating meat. It's not like if you want to eat meat, eat it. If you don't want to eat meat, don't eat it. Here, we're being commanded to put to death a murderer. So we don't have any choice in the matter. Of course, we do have a choice. We can disobey God. And that's what many nations do. They don't believe in capital punishment, regardless of what the scriptures say. As for you, be fruitful and multiply, populate the earth abundantly and multiply on it. Now that's part of the covenant that's not going to be followed by human beings. And we'll see that. Remember the story of the Tower of Babel? They all were of one language and they all were at one place. They did not fill the earth. And God had to correct that. there he, you know, when you read the Bible, God gave man dominion over the earth. And so, for the most part, as day passes and day passes and we go each day, God does not become involved directly in the affairs of the human race. Now, he is very involved indirectly in ways we can't always see. But for the most part, he gave man dominion and he doesn't violate that. And so, for example, slavery is an example of something that's wrong. But man made a decision to enslave other men, and God in his sovereignty chose not to become involved in that. If that's what men were going to do, that's what men were going to do. Although in the Mosaic Law, he greatly has a lot to say about it, because historically, before Israel, slaves were treated horribly. In the Mosaic Law, God mitigates that and gives the Jewish people rules to follow with their slaves so they are treated humanely and well. So there's an instance in which God had given dominion to man and did not violate that dominion. Sometimes he will say to himself, I have to get involved here. And so, for example, Sodom and Gomorrah, the wickedness of Sodom and Gomorrah were so great that God destroyed them. Now, he doesn't go around destroying wicked nations all over the place. We know that. And there are people who every time there's a, oh, there was a tsunami, God judged that country. We live in a cursed environment, a cursed universe. And one of the things that we experience because we live in a fallen world and the earth has been cursed is we experience evil. And evil can be defined as evil things that people do, but in the Bible, evils are also very tragic events, like a flood or an earthquake or something like that, a plague. Those are evils, and they exist on planet Earth because of the fall. Yes?
There are places in the Bible that talk about Satan causing those things to happen, those destructive things. So they're not, and I guess God lets it happen, or he allows it to happen.
What happened? Forgive me an example of something Satan did that God allowed to happen. Wait, I couldn't hear
it.
Oh, okay. You have to, if you find it, let me know. Now, it is true. It is true. There's no question but that Satan and his, all the fallen angels, the demons, are at war with God, and we're pawns in that war. And Satan does do things. People can become demon possessed. Satan does things. Yes, Satan does things, but we've got to remember, number one, Satan can only go as far as God allows him to. He can go no further. And Job is a good example of that. When Satan went before God, and God said, have you considered my servant Job, righteous man? And Satan says, sure he's righteous. Look, you've given him a multimillionaire easy life. God says, you can take everything away from him, just don't touch him. And that's what Satan did, but he didn't touch Job because he didn't have God's permission. And that's where Job says, naked came I from the womb, naked I will return. Blessed be the name of the Lord. The Lord is given, the Lord is taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And so, Satan went back to God, and God once again challenged Satan. Look what you've done to him, and he has been faithful. And Satan, what an evil entity, skin for skin. Gives you the chills. He wanted Job. So God said to Satan, you can afflict him, just don't kill him. And so that's what Satan did. He couldn't kill Job. He afflicted him horribly, but he didn't kill him. But anyway, when people look at a tragedy and automatically say this is judgment from God, there's no biblical basis for doing that, because tragic events became the norm with the fall. Earthquakes, tsunamis, floods, all of those things. That's just part of life on planet Earth right now. It does, all those things do result from sin, but you can't necessarily say, oh, you see how these people had this earthquake and 20,000 people died? They must have been very evil and God had to discipline, punish them. You can't draw that conclusion. That's an invalid conclusion. Okay? So, Noah disembarks, he builds an altar to the Lord and approaches God through a blood sacrifice, and then the Noahic covenant is entered into between God and Noah. And in 9:8 we read, I'm sorry, in 8:8 we read, no, not 8. 9, chapter 9, 8, we read, then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him. Now behold, I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you. So this covenant that God's about to enter into with Noah is going to be one that carries into successive covenants, because it applies to his descendants. And with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, of all that comes out of the ark, even every beast of the earth. So this is actually a covenant God's making with creation, in a sense, with animals as well as human beings and with the earth. I establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of a flood, neither shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And then God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I am making between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all successive generations. I set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of a covenant between you, me, and the earth. It shall come about when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the bow will be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant which is between me and every living creature of all flesh, and never again shall water become a flood to destroy the earth. When the bow is in the cloud, then I will look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of flesh that is on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. So now, when Noah disembarks, God enters into a new covenant with him, and we just read it. And basically speaking, the heart of the covenant is that God will never again bring a flood. There's other provisions in the covenant, for example, capital punishment and meat eating. But the main thing is God will never again destroy the animal world with a flood. Okay, then, after they disembarked, we have the story of Ham defiling Noah in chapter 9. Noah got drunk, and in his state of drunkenness, he was in his tent, and without going into too much detail, since he was drunk, he didn't cover himself. He was naked, he should have covered himself. And Ham went into the tent and he saw his father naked. And in that society, that was not good. It was not good. It kind of, for a child to see their parent naked in that culture was, took away from the parent all of the parent's dignity and authority. And then Ham goes out and tells his brothers, and his brothers walking backwards cover their father. And that has significance because now we have the three sons, and at the end of chapter 9, we have Noah giving an oracle for each son. An oracle is an ancient, more ancient word that later on in Scripture is called a prophecy. And Canaan, who was Ham's son, and through him his descendants would be cursed. They're going to be cursed, and they're going to be a servant. They're going to be servants of their brothers. And remember, when God often speaks to an individual, that applies to all of his descendants as well. And that's the case here. Shem, we're told, will be blessed. And specifically, what we're being told here is that the blessing that God wants to now give to mankind will come through the line of Shem. We have three. We have Shem, Japheth, and Ham. The blessing, the seed, is going to come through Shem. And then Japheth will multiply greatly and live peacefully with Shem. Okay, so the important thing here is to note that Shem, the blessing passes through the lineage of Shem, and that's going to be important soon. Okay, then we have the Table of Nations. That's in chapter 10. And the Table of Nations gives us Shem, Ham, and Japheth's genealogies and where their descendants settled. And that becomes significant later on when we start talking about nations in relationship with Israel. If you sit down to read in the Old Testament things that go on between the nations that surrounded Israel and Israel, remember that map? You still have that map? You can look at that map and see where these nations were. So we have the Table of Nations in chapter 10, and then in chapter 11 we have the story of the Tower of Babel. The story of the Tower of Babel. Now again, notice in 9:7, right? In 9:7, God said to Noah and through Noah to humanity, "Populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it." That was God's command. But then when we get over to chapter 11 and verse 3, it says, "They said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.'" Well, in fact, let's back up a little bit to verse 1. "Now the whole earth used to use the same language and the same words. And it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.' And they used bricks for stone, and they used tar for mortar. And they wanted to build a city and a tower. And they were violating Noah's command to spread out and populate the earth. They were all in one place. And so what happened was that when God saw this happening in chapter 11, verse 7, God says, "Come, let us go down." Notice the plural, us. "Let us go down there and confuse their languages so that they will not understand one another's speech." And that's the tool that God used to separate all these nations and have them follow, go, you know, spread out among the earth. Now, it would appear as though God did not just randomly give people different languages to speak. And so I'm walking all around and I speak French and I walk around and I don't understand what anybody's saying. All of a sudden I come across someone and we understand one another. Now we find somebody and now we have 300 people who all speak this language and 300 of us go off somewhere. That's not the way it was. It appears that when God confused the languages of people, he did it by tribe. And that's why the tribes stayed unified. So the different languages are languages that each of the tribes that came out of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, each one of those tribes was given a particular language that only that tribe understood. And so that tribe left and settled somewhere and became a nation. Okay? So, then the next thing that happens that's kind of interesting is we've already had that table of nations with all the genealogies, right? But we're in chapter 11. We get another genealogy of Shem. Why does that happen? All of a sudden God says, these are the records of the generation of Shem, and he gives us a genealogy of Shem that goes further than the previous one. And the significance of that is this. Remember I said the blessing would come through Shem in that oracle that Noah gave? Well, this genealogy works its way to Shem down to Abraham, indicating that the blessing would come through Abram. When we read chapter 11, verse 10, it says, these are the records of the generations of Shem. And when we go through all that genealogy and come down to verse 26, it says, Terah lived 70 years and became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. So you see how we have Abram now. And then the scripture starts to focus on Abram. And so we move now into chapter 12. And in chapter 12, we have the God's call of Abram. Notice his name hasn't been changed yet. We have God's call of Abram in chapter 12. And we have already discerned that the blessing is going to come through Abram. So this call must be significant. And so in chapter 12, we have the first mention of the Abrahamic covenant. Now, we want to go now to, make sure I got this right. Not yet. I left some, well, not really. I should have. Right. Something that happened, well, yeah, I could do it this way. Yeah, in chapter 12, we have the first mention of the Abrahamic covenant. And it's not the entire covenant because it's repeated a number of times in Genesis and provisions are added to it and it's expanded and explained and so forth. But in chapter 12, it says, starting from verse 1, now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you. So that's kind of like, well, let me finish what God said. And make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. And in your seed all the families of the earth will be blessed. So that's the first mention of the Abrahamic covenant. Now, like I said, it's mentioned a number of times in Genesis. And to really understand the Abrahamic covenant, the first thing you need to do is take all the times it's mentioned in Genesis and read all of them so you can get the full picture of what this covenant involves. If there is a most important covenant in the scriptures, it's this one, because it's the foundation of the plan of redemption. It's a very important covenant. Okay? So, when God gave Abram the Abrahamic covenant, notice how Abraham reacts. In verse 8, then he proceeded there to the mountain on the east of Bethel. Abram obeyed the Lord, and he followed, went where the Lord wanted him to go, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. And so again, the approach to God is always through a blood sacrifice. Now, you see where it says called upon the name of the Lord? That could be translated proclaimed the name of the Lord. And that might be a better translation, that he was, because he lived in a pagan world. And it's quite possible he was doing the work of an evangelist in a sense. Okay? But the three major provisions of the Abrahamic covenant, and this is what gets expanded on as we go further in the scripture, are the promise regarding the land, the promise regarding the seed, and the promise regarding the blessing. Those are the three major provisions of the Abrahamic covenant. Now, when Abraham left, remember, Abraham's brother had passed away. And so Lot didn't have a father. He was an orphan. So when Abraham went on this journey, he took Lot with him. And there's a few things that happened along the way. But one of the things that happened was they both became prosperous. And the land, they were still living together, but each had his own property, his own herds and stuff. So it got to be to the point where the land couldn't sustain them, and there was strife between the shepherds of Abraham and the shepherds of Lot. So Abraham went to Lot and said, there shouldn't be strife between us. Let us separate. And he said to Lot, if you want to go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you want to go to the right, I'll go to the left. He left it up to Lot. And Lot looked, and when he looked at the plains of Jordan and saw how well watered they were, he chose that area. And so Lot and Abram separated. Okay? But as Lot journeyed, he journeyed down all the way to Sodom, and he came to live and even be a leader in Sodom. Now, he was a righteous man, but he was not where he should have been. You know? I don't know if it still exists, but somewhere near New York, there's an island. I can't remember the name of it. I don't know if it's still, but I remember from back in the 60s and 70s it was there. It was like a homosexual island that, homosexuals live there and populated that island. What? Who? Men. Men. Now, If I, for some reason, went to that island, I don't know why in the world I'd ever do that, but if for some reason I went to that island and I met somebody and it became quite clear to me, quite clear, that that person was a believer, I would probably say to that person, what are you doing here? Why in the world are you living here? I'd want to know. Because we're supposed to separate ourselves from this, shouldn't we? I mean, I could understand going there to preach the gospel and then leaving, but I can't understand making your home there. Lot was a righteous, saved man, and he was not a homosexual. He was a married man, but he lived in Sodom. Okay. Then in chapter 13, the Abrahamic covenant is affirmed. And in chapter 13, starting from verse 14, it says this: the Lord said to Abram after Lot had separated from him, now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land which you see I will give to you. And notice this, and to your descendants forever. So the Abrahamic covenant is an eternal covenant. And anyone who says that the Jewish people do not have the rights to own Israel, our response is, we'll take that issue up with God, because he gave it to them. I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can be numbered. Arise, walk about through the land, its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. So you can see that that's the Abrahamic covenant again being expanded a little bit. Okay? Okay, let's take our break now. That concludes the review. Now, we're now in Genesis chapter 14, and we want to begin by reading verses 1 to 12. 1 to 12. And then we'll see what the notes have to say. And it came about, let me say something before we start reading this, because we're going to be reading about some nations now that go to war. Back in these days, right, quite often, a nation was not what we think of as a nation today. When we think of a nation today, we think of people numbering in the millions, don't we? I mean, think of every nation, you know, in the world. In these days, it was not unusual for nations to be much smaller. We would call them a clan or a tribe today. They weren't as big as they are now. So that makes this story a little more understandable. You don't have millions of people involved. You may even have hundreds of people involved. Okay. And it came about in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim, that they made war with Berak, king of Sodom. Now notice Sodom. Who lives in Sodom? Lot. And with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All of these came as allies to the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, but the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth Kornayim and in Zuzim in Ham and the Emen in Shava Kiriathaim and the Horites in their Mount Seir, as far as El Paran, which is by the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and they conquered the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who lived in Hazazon Tamar. Now here's the important part. Why what's all this about? Here's what's significant. And the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah and the king of Admah and the king of Zeboim and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, came out, and they arrayed for battle against them in the valley of Siddim. So there's battles, there's four kings going against five kings here, or four armies united against five armies united. Okay? And the idea is that this group of nations that were had been serving this particular king rebelled. Okay? Against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, this verse 9, and Tidal, king of Goyim, and Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. Now the valley of Siddim was full of tar pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, and they fell into them, but those who survived fled to the hill country. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food supply and departed. You see what happened here? The king of Sodom and the other kings that he was in league with, they were getting beat. So they fled. So this other group of kings took the spoils of war and they left. But notice what it says in verse 12. This is why this is significant to us. Then they also took Lot, Abram's nephew, and his possessions and departed, for he was living in Sodom. So they took people. What these countries, these kings did, obviously, was they took all the valuable objects, you know, gold, silver, stuff like that, precious jewels. But it seems as though they didn't just kill everybody. What they did was they took people as part of their victory, part of what they won by the victory, and they would have them be slaves. That was probably their intent. Okay, in the notes, the deliverance of Lot. Because notice, Lot is now captured, and he's going to be a slave here because he was living in Sodom, and Sodom fell to these countries, and so these kings went and took the spoils of Sodom, including Lot. The record of the battle of the four kings against the five is interesting, for it is part of the outworking of God's promise to Abram. It should be to make Abram great and to bless those who blessed him and curse those who cursed him. Chapter 14 describes a typical international skirmish in the ancient world in which powerful nations formed a coalition to plunder and subjugate areas near the border of the land promised to Abram. Okay? So we see what's happening here. It's one group of nations against another group of nations, and every time they conquer a nation, they take the spoils, they take slaves, and so forth. In an effort to put down a rebellion, four powerful eastern kings invaded the Jordan Valley near the Salt Sea, that is the Dead Sea. That's right at the bottom, the southern end of Israel. Defeating all the forces in the region, plundering the five Jordanian kings, and taking Lot captive. So, at this point, at least up to this point, Lot's living in Sodom seems to be working out to his disadvantage. Okay, now, what I want to do here, you see Roman numeral 3 and 4 there? Those from 3 and 4 just go into whether or not these kings have been identified, and for the most part they haven't. It really doesn't relate to the plot. So I'm not going to take the time to just read this. There's nothing to exposit here. There's nothing to interpret. So read Numbers 3 and 4. You can read that on your own. It's just goes a little bit into the archaeological finds and stuff like that. But we want to go now to page 61, number 5, and pick up the narrative. The four kings, Chedorlaomer, Tidal, Amraphel, and Arioch, went down the eastern side of the Jordan, turned around in the Arabah, the Rift Valley south of the Dead Sea, went up to Kadesh, over to Tamar, and then to the region of Sodom and Gomorrah in the valley of Siddim. And again, if you have those maps, you can check those maps out and see what they're doing, yes? Thank you. Interesting.
Yes, but not
okay, so the thing that's significant about all this, go with me to number 6. The five cities of the plain were apparently close together at the southern end of the valley. The four kings with whom they battled looted Sodom and Gomorrah and captured Lot. That's the important thing. They captured Lot. Okay, so now Lot has been captured. He's part of the spoils of war. Okay, that's the important thing. Now, verses 13 and 16. Then a fugitive came and told Abram the Hebrew that he was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, the brother of Anar, and these were allies with Abram. It was quite common when you had, we can call them nations, but they weren't big enough really today to be considered a nation. When you had nations or tribes that were all located in the same area, what they would often do is they would enter into a covenant with each other. And what that covenant would say was, we will not go to war with one another, we'll live peacefully. And if any one of us is attacked, we all will go to war with the attacker. It was very common for them to have that kind of agreement there. Okay? So that's the thinking behind. Now, he was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother Eshcol and brother Ramah, and these were allies with Abram. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he led out his trained men born in his house, 318. So you can see these were just more like tribes than they would be like big nations like the United States. 318. And went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. He brought back all the goods and also brought back his relative Lot with his possession and also the women and the people. So he set everybody free that had been taken captive. Now notice, he didn't take any spoils. And there's a reason for that. He didn't take any spoils of war, which normally one would do. There's a reason for that that we'll get to. Verse 13 to 16, page 62. Hearing of the invasion and the capture of Lot, Abram mustered his 318 trained men and together with his allies pursued and defeated the invaders in a night attack. Okay. He pursued them all the way to Dan, the future northern border of the Promised Land, which would be 140 miles from Abram's home in Hebron. Dan was then named Leshem. We get that from the book of Joshua. It was named Dan when the land was divided up amongst the sons of Jacob. Actually, the tribes. The descendants of the sons of Jacob. During the night, Abram pursued them on to Hobah, another 100 miles north of Dan. This was quite a pursuit. And brought back Lot and his possessions and family and other captives. This was a striking victory for the patriarch over four leading kings who had previously conquered such an extensive portion of Transjordania and the area south of the Dead Sea. So this is a real military victory on the part of Abram. And of course it affected his standing in the area. Abram the Jew was now recognized as a clan leader. This is the first occurrence of the Bible in the Bible of the word Hebrew. Though the term Hebrew should not be equated with the later group of marauding soldiers known as Hebiru, it may be etymologically related. In other words, the two words are not really related to one another, but they may have come from an earlier, they both may have been developed from an earlier common word. Okay? It may be etymology. Does everybody understand what it means when it says etymologically related? Etymology is the study of where did words come from. And a good dictionary will have an etymology of a word. And sometimes a dictionary will say that this particular English word came from an earlier English word, which came from a Greek word. And you look at what each one of those words meant, and it can enlighten you as to the meaning of that word you're studying. That's etymology, the source of words. Where did words come from? Because most of the words that we use are not really original. They're just variations of other words, and quite often variations of words from other countries. Okay? For example, the word antibiotic. If we did an etymology of that, what? We got anti, that always means against, and biotic, life. Antibiotics are against life, and that's what they do. They kill things. Hopefully they don't kill us, but when you take an antibiotic, it's designed to kill the bacteria that's in your body. So if you did looked up the etymology of antibiotic, that's pretty much what you'd find. And it would also tell you what language did it originally come from, okay? Okay. Let's see, where am I? This is first question. In fact, Abram's military action in this chapter shows that this meaningful designation fits. He was thus a force to be reckoned with among the nations. Lot's dwelling in Sodom was the means of Abram's being drawn into the conflict. Otherwise, he would not have gotten involved. Abram was dwelling in Hebron, but had a covenant with Mamre the Amorite and his brothers Eshcol and Aner. And again, this is his concept of living in peace and mutual support for one another. They were allies. Here, this covenant worked in favor of Abram, for these Amorites who allowed him to dwell with them had to fight with him. When the term Amorite is used alone, it refers to Western Semitic peoples living in the Transjordan kingdoms in the hill country of Canaan. These Amorites were a small ethnic group, not the large wave of Amorites who poured into ancient Sumer. And the West was a smaller tribe. Okay? Uh, Okay, 13. Abram was the general and the victory was attributed to him. Verse 17. However, this does not fully explain the triumph. Later, and we're going to be reading about this next time, Melchizedek attributed the victory to God as part of God's blessing on Abram. God was working through the life of Abram in accordance with his promise. When invaders plundered the land and stole his troublesome relative, Abram instinctively sprang into action. Israel would thus learn. Now remember who this was written to. The Jewish people, just having come out of bondage in Egypt and traveling towards Israel, what would become Israel, and wandering in the wilderness for 40 years, and then another next generation that went into Israel and succeeding generations. And notice what it says. Israel would thus learn that God would give his chosen people victory over enemies that plundered the promised land. So by reading this history of their forefather, they could apply it to themselves, because God, through Moses, had done for them what Abraham did for Lot, and there's a principle involved there. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. This must have encouraged God's people in the time of the judges and then later invasions. You know, in Judges, there were a lot of Israel was being invaded left and right. And there was a lot of Israel wasn't doing too well during this time spiritually. But there were spiritual Jewish people, like, you know, the story of the book of Ruth took place during the time of the judges. And especially believers who believed the word of God that they had up to that point could take comfort in the fact that God would protect them against their enemies. Okay? Of course, faith and obedience to God were prerequisites to victory, always. Yeah, let me just make mention of one thing, and I'll probably say this again next time, but it's interesting, and I'd like to say it now. You know how we're going to see Abraham didn't take any spoils, did he? And when the king of Sodom came and offered Abraham some spoils, he refused. Right? And notice that when Abram wanted a cave in which to use for a burial site for his wife, the man who owned that cave said to Abraham, take it. And Abraham said, no, I want to buy it. He didn't want it given to him. And all of those events, Abraham not taking spoils of war, Abraham refusing to take anything from the king of Sodom for what he had done, and also what was the third one that I just said? Excuse me? Oh, yeah, the burial place for Sarah. In all these instances, Abraham refused to just take them. And the reason is because all of what he was being offered was promised to him by God. And Abraham didn't want to rely on man in order for the promise to be fulfilled. The promise was made by God. And so Abraham's thinking throughout all of this was, God has promised this to me. I'm not going to show bad faith in my relationship with God and take it from you. It's going to be mine, but God's going to give it to me, not man. See that? And so we'll, as we go on, we'll see those events. Abram paid for the cave. He didn't take anything from the king of Sodom. And he didn't take the spoils of war because they were promised to him by God. And he wanted to wait faithfully until God gave them to him. Okay, now that's where we'll stop for today.